Hey, this evening, as you can see from the title slide, we're in our eighth class on Deuteronomy, and so I'm not sure if I showed you this picture before, but it is one of the better ones of the plains of Moab. This is not actually Mount Nebo in the distance here, but it's exactly like that, and so this entire ridge of mountains along here, Nebo I think would be just a little bit further to the right, but you know, it's exactly like this as far as the distance and the height, and gives an overview of Israel, of course, which is magnificent. The overview is all that Moses would ever know. He had sinned. He had been goaded into that sin by the unfaithfulness and the endless whining and griping and complaining of the Jews of old. And so, in his own failure, he would be deprived of the great physical prize, the earthly prize, of entering into this land flowing with milk and honey. So he viewed it from afar, and he's brought these Jews to this location, where they are receiving the second law, Deuteronomos, second law. And we'll shortly then, of course, be marching across the Jordan on dry land and taking up that promised land. I have shown you so many pictures of the desert, though, I thought it might be a good idea to say that, you know, if Moses and the Israelites were coming into Israel today, they would probably be staying here. It happens that just up the beach, a little bit south of the plains of Moab that you see right here, you know, it's just a big cluster of luxury resorts. Now, I like this particular photo, though, because it was the clearest one I could find from the eastern shore, from the Jordanian side of the Dead Sea, which shows you the whole northern end of the Dead Sea right there, and then you can just see so plainly the plains. And so right up, where would it be? Right there. This ridgeline right in here is where Jerusalem is. So when you're in Jerusalem on a really clear day, if you can get to the ridgeline, you can look down all the way and see this particular resort. Now here's just another one, but once again, you can see the plains of Moab. And from this low position, then, you can appreciate how huge it is. Several miles across, you know, many miles long, and certainly room enough for any number of Jews, however many that number is now, after the 40 years of the wilderness wandering. It's thought that there may have been as many as a million people in there, and there's plenty of room to do it. Now, this evening, though, as I mentioned last week, starting with chapter 12 especially, you really begin to feel the Deutero part of this Namas. And so now we're getting a lot of fairly quick repetition of what we studied in much more detail when we did Leviticus immediately before this class on Deuteronomy. So we picked up the pace quite a bit last week, covered five chapters last week, and I'm hoping to cover five chapters again this evening. But again, the nature of the material here does not lend itself really very well to chart making and photographs and that sort of thing. And so tonight, all I'm going to do is put up these outline slides. So hopefully I can get through chapters 16, 17, 18, 19, and 20. That's what I'm going to shoot for. And then for each one of those chapters, if you'd like to take the time while I'm reviewing and doing an overview of each of these sections, you can go ahead and identify it in your Bible. What I do is I just take a little ruler, one of those little plastic rulers, you know, that you can see through, so I can make sure I got my line straight based on the text, you know, that I can see below it. And then I use a wide margin Bible and just draw a straight line, you know, underneath verse 8 and verse 12 and verse 15 in this case. And then I'll make, you know, blocks and label them as you see on the slide. So later I might be hunting for something, and it's a much easier, faster way just to reference through the book. So tonight we're going to start with chapter 16's first eight verses, and it is about the Passover. So in verse 1, observe the month of Abib, their first month, akin to our January, but actually in April, May. And celebrate, it says, the Passover to Yahweh your God. Those who are visiting, I'm usually in the habit of instead of saying Lord, replacing it with the actual personal name of God. Oddly enough, and unhappily enough, the Jews of old had, in a show of reverence, which I'm not so sure was really helpful, but in a show of reverence, never uttered the name, and it has become difficult these so many centuries later to know exactly how to pronounce it. Pretty really sure it's not Jehovah. That's the most popular form you hear today, but the Hebrew letters wouldn't sound like that. And so the best that we can estimate today, the best guess that we have today, is that the personal name of our Father is Yahweh. The convention in many Bibles, and certainly the one I have, and I think many of you have tonight, anytime you see the word Lord or the word God in all capital letters, it will, whether it's translated God or Lord, be Yahweh in the Hebrew back behind it. So the way they designate that it's the personal name is having all capitals for either the word Lord or the word God. So for visitor's sake, you'll be hearing me doing that quite a bit here this evening. Observe the month of Abib, celebrate the Passover to Yahweh, your God. For in the month of Abib, Yahweh your God brought you out of Egypt by night. And you shall sacrifice the Passover to Yahweh your God from the flock and the herd in the place where Yahweh chooses to establish his name. What place is that? It is Jerusalem. Now certainly the country would qualify as a place and his name is attached to it, but this is about eventually choosing the city of the Jebusites, Jerusalem, as the location for the temple and the center of their worship. Verse 3 adds to this, you shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread, the bread of affliction. For you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, in order that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. It won't be much longer that people will be able to remember that in the group that's here. You'll remember, everybody over the age of 20 died in the wilderness. So these people, at the most, could be 60 years old. Well, typical lifespan, you know, means that they're going to be dying out here in due time. And these people then, you know, pretty soon will be the last of this first and only generation that experienced the wilderness to remember these things. But nonetheless, this law is intended to be taught to the children, and there's a fullness of this discussion in Exodus and Numbers. And so you have then the perpetuation of this memory in the printed word. And so do this every year, this bread of affliction. Remember the haste, remember the horror, and remember the freedom. Verse 4, for 7 days no leaven shall be seen with you in all your territory. None of the flesh which you sacrifice on the evening of the first day shall remain overnight until morning. You're not allowed to sacrifice the Passover in any of your towns which Yahweh your God is giving you, but at the place where Yahweh your God chooses to establish his name. You shall sacrifice the Passover in the evening at sunset at the time you came out of Egypt. And that's an interesting and helpful thing, at sunset, you know, the time that you came out of Egypt. You shall cook and eat it in the place which Yahweh your God chooses, and in the morning you are to return to your tents. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread. And on the seventh day there shall be a solemn assembly to Yahweh your God. You shall do no work on it. Well, we saw this in greater detail back in Leviticus, and so we just, as we so often humorously say, we'll observe the Passover on it. But it is not the highest and most important of the feast days. What is the highest and most important of the feast days? The Day of Atonement. And what's particularly unique about that is the only time when a priest, and has to be a high priest, can what? Actually go behind the veil in the tabernacle, or what will become Solomon's temple. Also, it is the only day and the only time when there is a required what of the Jews? A fast. It's the only time they had to fast. A lot of fasting went down. God expected them to be fasting. It was understood that people would be fasting. Just like in the New Testament, repeatedly, we have statements about people doing it because it's understood godly people will participate in fasting for personal reasons. There's only one that's required and none under the new law. So, the Passover developed in several other places at greater length. Then we come to verses 9 through 12, where we have the second of the three feasts where every male above the age of 30 must go to Jerusalem. And so now we read in verses 9 through 12. You shall count 7 weeks for yourself, and that's after the Passover. You shall begin to count 7 weeks from the time you begin to put the sickle to the standing grain. Then you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks to Yahweh your God, with a tribute of a freewill offering of your hand, which you shall give just as Yahweh your God blesses you. In other words, it's up to you to give as you've been prospered. 11, you shall rejoice before Yahweh your God, you and your son and your daughter and your male and female servants and the Levite who's in your town and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your midst in the place where Yahweh your God chooses to establish his name. And you shall remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and you shall be careful to observe these statutes. So if you count off 7 times weeks, which is 7 times 7, how many days do you get? 49. But this is going to bring us then to a feast, which is called what in the New and Old Testament? The Feast of Pentecost. Pentecost means 50th, and so it's his 50th day feast. Now, once again, we know from other places, every male over the age of 30 has to go to Jerusalem for this feast. Of course, it's the significant one in Acts 2, upon which the Holy Spirit came. And then, verses 13, 14, and 15, we get the third of these feasts. You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths. We usually refer to that as the Feast of Tabernacles is the way you typically hear it, but either way, they were to set up a small temporary dwelling, you know, just a tiny room, maybe 10 by 10, something like that, and it would remind them again of wilderness wanderings. So it says, Feast of Booths, 7 days after you've gathered in from your threshing floor and your wine vat, you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son, your daughter, your male and female servants, a Levite, stranger, an orphan, a widow, are in your towns. 7 days, you shall celebrate a feast to Yahweh, your God, in the place which Yahweh chooses, because Yahweh your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you shall be altogether joyful. I didn't count, but it's quite a few times more than I think I've got fingers anyway, and maybe toes too, the expression Yahweh your God. This is all about separating this God, the Jews' God, the only true and living God, Yahweh the Lord, above all other so-called gods. So it's very personal, and repeatedly, you know, this phrase is used, you know, just embedding in these people's minds, you are altogether different from all these other nations in all your laws and certainly in all your sacrifices, everything you do, because Yahweh is your God. Don't you forget it.
During the time that David was king in Hebron, was the tabernacle in Hebron or in Jerusalem?
I think it was in either one. Was at that threshing floor, and I can see it now because I've been on the hill and looked across where it is, but I can't remember where it was. What's the name of the area where that temple or the tabernacle was? Too, with great rejoicing, and David's wife got in trouble when they brought it, you know, finally into Jerusalem. Bill, your mission, should you decide to accept, is to tell us next week what that is. I want to say, we spell it Shiloh, and we say Shiloh, but it's wrong. I know that's wrong. I know where Shiloh is, Hebrew pronunciation, and it's nowhere near, you know, Jerusalem. It was this threshing floor, you know, place, but it eludes me at the moment. So You've stumped the preacher for whatever that's worth tonight. You know, there's a grand prize. Take one of the pencils off the table when you leave. Okay, so I can't answer that one. That'll bring us now to verses 17 and 18, which I'm just calling a summary here of these three feasts. Every man shall give, excuse me, 16, I put there, should be 16 and 17. Three times in a year, all your males shall appear before Yahweh your God in the place which he chooses. At the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which we usually call the Feast of Passover. Feast of Weeks, which we usually call Pentecost. And the Feast of Booths, which we usually call Tabernacles. So Old and New Testament, you know, they come to have different names, same feasts. Every man shall give as he's able according to the blessing of Yahweh your God, which he has given you. So just a summary statement about those three times. This brings us to a judicial system, which, while much of it is specified, a good deal of it was left to the discretion of the Jews. And so we're going to get some character and attitudes, if you will, some principles about it. But there is not an extremely specific judicial system, if you will, that's been laid out in the Old Testament. It reads like this, starting in verse 18. You shall appoint for yourself judges and officers in all your towns, which Yahweh your God is giving you according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. Judge righteous judgment was a very statement Jesus also used in John's Gospel. Now verse 19, you shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which Yahweh your God is giving you. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of... You know, I know what I did there, but I really messed this up. 18 through 22. Okay, that actually is a bit of a mistake. I should have had another line here, and I just messed up. It should be, draw your line under verse 20. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which Yahweh your God is giving you, is the judicial system. Then you get the last two verses, which is about idols and totem poles. So I lost a line on here, but that's about idols and totem poles. 21. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of Yahweh your God, which you shall make for yourself. Neither shall you set up for yourself a pillar which Yahweh your God hates. I've got a footnote under Asherah in my Bible. It says a wooden symbol of a female deity. So, both cases, you've got a wooden symbol that is taking the form of some kind of pillar or pole. Now, I know it's not politically correct and all of that today, but what he is describing very precisely is a totem pole. That's what it is. So they have different faces on them, have different animals on them, and all the rest of that. But this is a thing that's just expressly forbidden the Jews there in verses 21 and 22. So you have a judicial system which is seeking absolutely and only what? Justice. And then they are forbidden to engage in idolatry. This is the umpteenth time that Moses has said this. They've had problems with it in the past. They'll have a lot of problems with it in the future. They don't seem to be able to learn their lessons, of course. But here it is in our second law. Okay, any comment or question on chapter 16? It's really very straightforward tonight. I'm sure we can go, really very fast. So the outline, I think, will serve you, as much as anything here this evening. Now, in chapter 17, we have a single verse that says, "You shall not sacrifice to Yahweh your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to Yahweh your God." And we're going to find this, you know, happening again and again now. You know, a single verse that's just all by itself, orphaned out there on the page. It's not directly related to anything. God is just guiding Moses to refresh the minds of these people in these last few days before they go in to occupy this land. What is the scope of their law? So you don't ever offer a sacrifice that's blemished. It's never seconds when you're giving something to your God. It's the first, it's the best, it's to have absolutely, you know, no stain upon it. Then you have verses 2-7, which, again, far from politically correct, even illegal today and all that, but death penalties were a lot more frequent and intensely instituted by God, and false religions are not going to be tolerated at all in this manner, verses 2-7. If there's found in your midst in any of your towns, which Yahweh your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of Yahweh your God by transgressing his, that's God's, covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun or the moon or any of the heavenly host, which I've not commanded, and if it's told you, you've heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. And behold, if it is true, and the thing certain, that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. On the evidence of two witnesses or three, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. Now, we've already come across in Leviticus and already last week in Deuteronomy the requirement of two or three witnesses. We're going to find out a little later in tonight's class that, as a matter of fact, that's not just in death penalty cases. In all cases, you are not going to accept the testimony of a single witness. How could you? You've got a single witness testifying about a single individual. There's a disagreement. Either this guy's wrong and this guy's right, or this guy's wrong and that guy's right, or they're both wrong, but they can't both be right. And so, without additional corroborating evidence, you cannot make a decision. You can't have justice when you've only got one person testifying. So, it'll be true, particularly in death penalty cases, of course, but really for everything here, as we'll see in a little bit. So what we've got, death penalty, all false religions in this case. And we saw that last week in chapter 13. So, you know, it's all very familiar to you. But still, let's just repeat it. If you just hear that somebody is unfaithful to Yahweh, what do you have to do personally? You got to go investigate. You have to go check it out. You have to go seek to find the witnesses. You're going to have to produce, you know, these witnesses in court. And if we've been through the judicial system that we just got set up at the end of the preceding chapter, well, then we're going to put them to death. And who's going to throw the first stone? You are. What do you suppose that would do to gossip in Israel? Anybody's ever tempted to tell a story about somebody else? I heard this or that. Then what happens to the gossiper? They just became an investigator. They'll have to throw the first stone if it's right. We'll have some very interesting laws along the way if it isn't, too. So we'll look for that. But at this point, if it's proven, you put them to death. And it's the witness's responsibility, first, to find out if any of this is going on, and second, to engage in the capital punishment itself as the first. But we've talked about that before, so we're going to do it again. We're going to look now at verses 8-13, where he simply says that the judgment of either the priest or a judge
Judges are going to be coming later. Priest or judge, as he looks to the future, is absolutely final. It's their Supreme Court. You don't argue with it.
If I hear about something, it's my responsibility to check into it. I'm actually not a witness.
No, that's correct. You're not a witness.
So I wouldn't be throwing the first stones. It's only the witnesses that throw the first stones.
You've caught me again tonight. That's a really good point. In 7, the hand of the witness shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So, a good point, and thank you for catching that. You're personally involved, but only the witnesses are actually casting the first stone. Stumbled on that one. I really appreciate you catching it. Okay, so now we're going to go 8 to 13. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go up to the place which Yahweh your God chooses. That will be the city of Jerusalem. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in those days, who's in office in those days. You shall inquire. They will declare to you the verdict in the case. You shall do according to the terms of the verdict which they declare to you from that place which Yahweh chooses. You shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they shall tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you to the right or the left. And the man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve Yahweh your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. My favorite story is several years ago now, but we've had this raging debate and essentially the near eradication of the death penalty in our country for a very long time. So you've all heard all these arguments and everything. But a guy went actually into a prison and he asked a thief what he thought of the death penalty. You know? And he said, "What, you think I'm stupid? Of course it works." Okay. Well, there's a guy that ought to know. So he's willing to do some thieving. He's willing to do some, you know, terrible things. But even these people who are supposed to be the worst of the worst and have no consciences and all the problems that they have, much, you know, that's just the fact of the matter, they still, the great majority, you know, understand what is obvious to any right-thinking person who hasn't got some kind of political agenda going. If we've actually got a system of laws which is being practiced up to and including the witnesses throwing rocks, then people are going to know about it. And when they do, of course it reduces crime. Of course it works. This is the simplest equation you can imagine. 1 + 2 = 3. That has always been the case. And God in His wisdom declares that it is so. It's just unarguable. And so it's been silly all these, you know, decades that we've been arguing about it in our country. Of course it does. I've added to that my own little caveat here, or, you know, addition if you like it. I'll tell you what. If you execute anybody, that always reduces crime. Because that guy will never commit another one. Okay? So you can't argue it doesn't reduce crime. It's certainly going to stop him from doing any more crime. And the rest of the world will see it and fear it, and it will work. So it's too bad we've abandoned it today. We're not Jews. This is not our law. But these principles are still true. And capital punishment is certainly taught in the New Testament. Wish it were so that it was still being practiced and practiced every time. That in a very long list of biblical offenses, that capital punishment would actually take place. Now, at this point, you can tell, you know, I'm rushing. It's all material we've talked about before. But I do want to slow down for a couple of minutes now. How wrong is this? See, I know what happened, and I just feel bad. But I thought that I could highlight a slide, and then I could do that find and replace feature
So I copied chapter 16 exactly where it was. Then I used that find and replace to replace all the 16s with 17s. Okay. I only later found out that it didn't work slide specific. It did that for all my slides. So then I had to run back and I started trying to get everything fixed, and I missed some of them. At any rate, we are in chapter 17. We are looking at 14 through 20. This is going to be called Rules for Kings, and so let's use that, Rules for Kings, 14 through 20. However, there are three very separate parts to this, and what I was about to say before I noticed that, you know, I messed up another chart, is that these three things I think are particularly important. I thought tonight, of all the things we'll look at tonight, we've had repetition everywhere else, tonight I do want to spend a little bit of time here. So, if you were sleeping, you don't wake up. This is where I won't pay attention here, which I see nobody's doing. But come to now 14, and we are going to look at a section, just two verses, out of these. So I didn't break it down on the slide, but 14 and 15 are interesting, to say the least. When you enter the land which Yahweh your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. You shall surely set a king over you, whom Yahweh your God chooses. From among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. So I mentioned a moment ago, they already have priests, but they don't have the judges, not at least in the formal sense we'll read in the book by the same name. But they will. So it's looking to the future. There's a prophecy there about the judges. Now we've got another prophecy about the next phase of the Jewish system, which is a monarchy. They're going to get kings. Now, here's what's really critically important. For those of you that have not been with us, you know, on Sunday mornings, this is a big deal on our marriage, divorce, and remarriage study. I've been saying constantly, you cannot find a place in your Old Testament where people rebel against God and God says, okay, then I will declare what was a sin to no longer be a sin because you've hardened your heart against me. I'm going to change my law so what was a sin isn't anymore and you can do it your way. This was what I believed for a lot of years about marriage, divorce, and remarriage when we get to Deuteronomy 24, as it's quoted and discussed in Matthew 19. I thought the statement in Matthew 19, Moses permitted you for the hardness of your hearts to divorce your wives. And I thought that meant that the hardness of heart was toward God, and that therefore God lowered his standard. He gave them a pass. He gave them a reduced law. He gave them less than what they had from the garden up to that point. And from that point on, they could divorce their wives for less than adultery. This was my conviction. I taught it for years. Counseled people to do it. That Deuteronomy 24 would be about something less than adultery because of Matthew 19. Now, we're going to be in Matthew 19 this very next Sunday. We're going to do it in very great detail. But several times I've had people come and say, well, Larry, you're wrong because of 1 Samuel chapter 8. So next to this passage in verse 14, please write in your margin 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 1 through 9. This is critically helpful. And then right underneath that in your margin here, write 1 Samuel 12, verses 12 through 15. So I've had several people come to me and say, well, Larry, you know you're wrong in this idea that God never lowers his standards because here it is. They wanted a king. This was wrong. They rebelled against God. And so he lowered his standards. So see, he does do that. Now let's see if there's any kind of a parallel here. In the first place, if God is prophesying a thing that he's already doing. He is a king. They are his kingdom. Is it a sin to have a king or to be a king or to function as a kingdom? No, that was never a sin. It was never a moral failing. So, is it wrong morally for the people to have a king?
Well, no more than it is for God to be one. And it's prophesied. It was a part of God's plan from the beginning. Here it is. When you enter the land, you say, I'll set a king over us like the nations around us. Then I'll pick the king, God says. All right. Now, holding this passage, come on over to 1 Samuel 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Now, I have no doubt that people harden their hearts. I have no doubt that they harden their hearts against God. I have every doubt that what God did was in lower his standard and declare that what used to be a sin no longer is. This is what I thought he was doing, you know, with marriage and divorce, but here, you know, not so. When you read it, 1 Samuel 8, verse 9, first 9 verses came about. Samuel's old, he appointed his sons judge over Israel. Name of the first is Joel, name of the second is Abijah. They're judging in Beersheba. His sons, however, did not walk in his ways, but turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice. Now stop. Would it be a sin for somebody to say, we don't like these guys ruling over us? What are these guys doing? They don't walk in God's ways. They're going after dishonest gain. They take bribes and they pervert justice. So it'd sure be wrong if we complained about that, wouldn't it? We just got to accept that. We got to say that's okay. Well, they got every right to say this is terrible. We don't want to live under this. I'd be right there with them. This has to stop. It should stop. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together, came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, behold, you've grown old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. Samuel prayed to Yahweh. Yahweh said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all they say to you, for they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me from being king over them, like all the deeds which they've done since the day I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, and that they've forsaken me and served other gods, so they're doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them, which he will do. Okay? This is not the lowering of a moral standard. It's the transition from patriarchal law to Levitical judges to the judges to the kings. And all perfectly legal, nothing sinful or immoral about it. It's too bad they didn't stick with the old system, but God knew they were going to, you know, want a king, and he was a king. It's okay to have a king. So he said, okay, but you'll be sorry. It's better the way I got it going right now, but you can have your own way if you want, because what you want is not inherently evil. It's not wrong. It's not a sin to have a king. It's not a sin to be mad that justice is being perverted. Yeah, there's no parallel in what I used to think was happening in Matthew 19. But wait for Matthew 19 now, and you'll see that much more clearly next week. While we're here, though, in 1 Samuel, come on over to chapter 12 now, because this is taken up again in chapter 12. Get over there, and look at my own note. I can't remember. It's verses 12 through 15. Here we go. 12:12 says this. When you saw that Nahash, the king of the sons of Ammon, came against you, you said to me, no, but a king shall reign over us, although Yahweh your God was your king. It's not a sin to have a king. Now therefore, here's the king, whom you've chosen, whom you've asked for. Behold, Yahweh set a king over you. Can Yahweh commit a sin? Well, no. He's not changing anything. He told Moses they were going to do this. It was a part of his plan from the beginning. It was always going to be they would have a king. Was Jesus going to be a king? Well, sure. It's just they didn't like the king they had, because in the system they had at the moment, they had a handful of guys who were perverting justice and everybody's suffering. That's what they didn't like. That's what they didn't want. But they made the mistake of saying, we're going to vest more power in what? In a human king. So God said to him, you do that, you're going to pay for this in taxes and conscription, you know, in the military and everything. But it's perfectly fine. I foretold that you would, so you can go ahead and do it. And he did. Okay, no comparison on the marriage divorce front. So now, let's come back and get through 17 at least tonight. I'm bogging down, obviously. Go to 16 and 17 now. Moreover, this is that king I'm going to set. He shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now, what makes this one interesting, and it bears a little bit on the marriage-divorce thing, but more broadly as well, though it's the marriage-divorce thing, you know, that usually brings it up. I couldn't tell you how many times I've listened to preachers say, here is where God forbids polygamy. Finally, after permitting it for all these years, long before Moses, polygamy was perfectly healthy, happy, and good, not a thing wrong with it, never criticized, never forbidden, never anybody, you know, in trouble because of practicing it. Now, we come to this statement, and it's been twisted to say that polygamy is an evil thing in and of itself. So they teach, here God is raising the law. Moses' standard is higher than all the nations around them, and polygamy is forbidden. Is that so? And before, you know, I tell you why I think it can't possibly be, in your own mind, think about the context and ask yourself, is this an absolute prohibition against having a second wife if you're a Jew under Moses' law? No. My mom was, from childhood, involved with horses. Eventually, she got into purebred Arabians. They had 5 acres, stalls for 40 horses, and regularly I used to tell her what sinner she was. Why would I do that? Well, doesn't this passage forbid having more than one horse? Doesn't that say forever? If you ever have a second horse, you're a sinner? Doesn't it? Well, of course not. And I never met a preacher who thought so. Yet, they would just throw the horses away and pick on the polygamy. Can't have more than one wife. Anybody ever, it's against polygamy. Well, then you can't have more than one horse either. Can you? What else does it say? It says, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Who was the richest man ever in Israel? Solomon. And who gave him his money? Scripture specifically says that God did. So is there a sin there when Solomon became richer than Croesus? No, not in that. So what's the sin here? And who alone is it directed at? The king when you set him up. We took one part out of three, turned it into a general prohibition for everybody when the context specifically limits it to the king. Why? Because the king's got in trouble with this a lot. Why did they multiply horses? Because they didn't trust their God to win the battle. And Deuteronomy says so. That was specified as the problem. Why did they take multiple wives? Kings did. Why? Treaty alliances with neighboring countries, which was forbidden to the Jews to intermarry with these other peoples anyway. But they thought they could prevent war by breaking God's command and marrying into those nations anyway. What did they want all the money for? To pay for the armies. This is not a prohibition against having a lot of any one of these three things. It's a prohibition of a king losing faith in his God, so he starts trusting in military equipment, read horses, alliances, read more wives, and in money, read military budget. And it's explained in other places in the Old Testament. So tonight, I know that's highly controversial, and it might be blowing up one of your most treasured verses, but there's not a word in the world here about polygamy being wrong under Moses' law. Any more than it says you can't buy a second horse. That would have been the end of our entire estate. Because my folks were breeding mares, and we needed two horses to do that. Okay, Bill.
It was also mentioned that having all these wives would lead him astray from following.
And then came the idolatry because you've married into a foreign country. That's it. When you study the whole thing out, there is no prohibition against polygamy here any more than there is for Solomon being wealthy. It's what you do with it as a king that can get you in trouble when you lose faith. Okay, now the last part. The last part is verses 18 through 20. It shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. So now he's got witnesses to make him do it. It'll be with him. He'll read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear Yahweh as God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in the kingdom of the midst, in the midst of Israel. God always intended for Israel to have kings. He foretells it to Moses hundreds of years before they ever do. He doesn't change his plan at all in that case. They chose a lesser thing over a greater thing, but it wasn't sinful or wrong, and God didn't change his plans. And then, when God said, okay, I'll let you do that, it's not smart, but I'll let you do it, and then I'll show you how it's going to go wrong for you, and if you still want to do it, you can, but I'll appoint the guy. That's not a sin either, and when I do, though, I'll do the best I can to rein him in. So we're going to, you know, have this rule where you have to write it out. This is my handwritten copy of the New Testament. Many years ago, I decided, you know, if that was good enough for those kings, there might be some wisdom in that. So I started writing Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, back on, because I carefully, you know, dated these, in September of 1988, and I finished the book of Revelation here, that's Proverbs, I got into the Old Testament too, in 2001. So from 88 to 2001 is how long? Well, it's 13 years. It took me 13 years to do this. But brethren, those of you who have been here regularly, you've all heard me, you know, say, please do this. It will so change your life. It's awesome. Truly awesome. God knows how your head works. And I learned in this command that carrying a thought that you've just read long enough to transmit it down your arm and write it out forces synapses to go into play that don't otherwise. I don't know how many times I would go, oh, how many times have I read that and I never saw that before? Just leaping off the page with all these new ideas because I was writing it down. So go out and get 6 spiral-bound notebooks, college ruled 100 sheets. Okay, and get started, brethren. Now, I've been asking people to do this since 1988. That's a while. One person so far has told me that they've started doing it. Two. Okay, there's two. I won't embarrass you to ask you how it's going, but it took me a long time. But it's just really smart because it's God's wisdom. So he's trying to rein these kings in. He's making them write it down. Now, whether he meant just the book of Deuteronomy or the 5 books of Moses, or eventually, as years go by and prophets come along, the king would have to write out everything from Genesis up to his current time. So Hezekiah would be writing Isaiah's prophecies. Okay? Oh, and by the way, if he was writing Isaiah's prophecies, what are the other 3 contemporary prophets to Isaiah? You better know this. Who are the 4 prophets in Isaiah's day? Isaiah's one. Who are the other 3? Ahem. You're so
pathetic.
Amos. Yeah, yeah. Amos. All right, those of you, you're laughing in the back there because you don't know what I'm doing up here. I had this memory trick where I would clear my throat to remind everybody of A-H-I-M. We usually spell it E-M, but A-H-I-M stands for Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. That's your way to remember the 4 contemporary prophets of Hezekiah's time, 700s B.C. Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, Micah. Okay? So, I think it's probably just Deuteronomy. Probably that's what he means. But I did the entire New Testament vastly larger, you know, than that. If you just pick at it, I typically would write for about 30 minutes a day in the morning. Brethren, I just am begging you to do this. It'll change your life. It'll make you a better Christian. It'll make you a better Bible student. It made them better kings. And that's why God had them do it. Okay? So there's no sin involved here. God prophesied it from the beginning. God regulated it from the beginning. And God tried to give them, since he picked them, good kings. But they didn't all choose to do it. Now, obviously I'm not going to see chapter 20, but in 5 minutes, I might get a big chunk out of chapter 18 because it goes a lot faster now. And you'll notice we're getting fewer in each of these successive chapters, lines on my chart, because we get bigger blocks of information. So we've got rules for priests in chapter 18's first 8 verses. And I don't think we even need to read it. They're not going to have an inheritance. You know, they take up the tithing so that they can eat of it. It's all stuff we studied in Leviticus. Then you go to verses 9 through 14. See, and again, I messed everything up. It should be 9 through 14. Oh, I'm in. What have I done here? There it is. Wrong slide. So rules for priests in 18, 1 through 8. Then 9 through 14 is against idolatry and sorcery. So here we go again. We've been through all this in Leviticus. When you enter the land, you don't learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations, and so they're going to offer their children to idols. And you know, we've been through all of that before. So then we have, though, and I'll have to come back to this next week. I don't want to rush this. And we touched on it last week, as a matter of fact, because it's relationship to chapter 13. But now we have another prophecy of Christ. This, and by the way, the people rebelled against God. Everyone, not one, has been righteous. And when everybody sins, does God lower his standard or send a Savior to pay for it? God never lowers his standard. You just don't measure up to it. But he then either punishes up to and including physical death and or gives you the out. Verses 15 through 19 is the prophecy of Christ. It is a prophecy quoted in Acts chapter 3, verse 22, and again in Acts chapter 7, verse 37. It is a preeminent passage of the coming of Christ. So we'll come back to it next week. And then just so you get the outline, death to the false prophets again. So 20 through 22, let's read that one. The prophet who shall speak a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he shall speak in the name of other gods, that prophet shall die. You may say in your heart, how shall we know the word which Yahweh has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of Yahweh, if the thing does not come about or come true, that's the thing which Yahweh has not spoken. The prophet has spoken it presumptuously. You shall not be afraid of him. And if you're in my class last week, you'll have in your margin a reference to Jeremiah. What are the verses? It's Jeremiah chapter 14, verses 14 through 16. Where many years later, Jeremiah is going to say exactly the same thing. They're going to die, these false prophets. Now, with that, I'll let you go, you know, a few moments early, because this 18, 15 through 19, quoted twice in the book of Acts as the gospel is just taking off, you know, it is central to God's plans. Okay? Comment or question? All right, class dismissed now.